Let's go for it then. This is an oral history recording for Westminster School on the 6th of February 2020 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist.
And Felicity Crow, archives assistant.
And Terence Bendixson, former, well, old Westminster.
So I'd like to start off by asking people a little bit about their background to set the scene. And I wondered if you could tell us where you were born and a little bit about what your parents did.
Yes. I was born in Kimpton in Hertfordshire in the Stockbroker Belt on the 3rd of August 1934. And my father was indeed a stockbroker. and just down the road from Kimpton was my grandfather's house. He was a Swedish Jew who came to London in the 1880s, opened a bank, borrowed money cheaply in the London markets, and then lent it more expensively in Scandinavia, and became a very rich man. And my father, when he and my mother married, moved out next to him. And I guess my father commuted into London, and that was where I first saw the light of day.
And did you get to know your grandfather fairly well, if you were so close to him?
No, he made a terrible commercial mistake in 1929. He died in the midst of the Wall Street crash. And one day he was a rich man, and in the 30s my father and his brothers were paying off my grandfather's debts because everything went down the tubes.
And do you have... what are your memories like of the war?
Well, yes, very much so, because I have a sister, Teresa, and in 1940 she and I were shipped off to Montreal as quite a lot of well-to-do children of well-to-do families were. My parents both stayed behind. My mother joined the Women's Army. My father joined the Air Force. And my sister and I were lodged with Scots merchant families in Montreal, the sort of leading citizens in Canada, people who wanted to do something for the war effort. So my father wrote to the Drummonds at one point, and they said, no, there's no point in your paying. We want to help you. So we had an amazing childhood, well-to-do people, very, very supportive of us. In the country, in the summer, we all lived out in the country, in country houses with lakes and other children. And I remember it as an idyllic childhood. But there was only one snag, and that was, I think, my sister and I, but perhaps I suffer from it more than she did. I just felt my parents didn't love me, and there was this sort of... I covered it up, of course, as children do, but I just knew that there was something terribly painful about my life, and that that continued for quite a long time.
Do you remember the journey to Canada?
Oh, yes. Taking the train up to Liverpool... The train coming right down beside the ship and the wheels squealing in the rails because they were sort of full of rubbish or whatever it was beside the boat. Getting onto the Duchess of York, and then at some point, I was obviously a greedy little boy, so another boy gave me some chocolate, and it was a kind of chocolate called Ex-Lax, and it was what's the word I'm hunting for? I'm going to have to stop. what is it when you take something to make your bowels...
Oh, a laxative. Yeah. A laxative effect.
Right, yeah. It was a laxative chocolate. Oh, and that was my first discovery of laxatives.
Did you have an adult accompanying you?
Yes, yes. I don't remember anything about her. My sister was 2 years older than me, so she was my big sister, and I'm sure she was pretty important.
Mm. And you mentioned other siblings, so brothers?
No, there were just two of us.
Just the two of you.
Yes.
And then, so after the war had ended, you came home?
Came back to London. By then, my father had died. He was at the fall of Singapore and was subsequently captured by the Japanese, died in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. So my mother was on her own, and we lived just 400 yards over there in Drayton Gardens. And that's where I started to walk down these streets here to take the 11 bus, first to go to the under school and then on to Westminster.
And so you went to the Westminster Under School, the school's prep school, which was founded in 1943. So you were there really for the early days of that school.
Yes.
And it was it based in Little Dean's Yard at that point?
Yes, it was. Yes. And Mr. Murray was the head of it, I think. And John Carlton, who subsequently became head of the school, of the main school, he was a lodger. I used to have breakfast with him.
And was it based in what's now Grant's house? I'm trying to remember.
It was the left hand most of the three houses, the one in the corner.
Yes, okay, the one that's now the master of the Queen Scholars House.
Yes.
Were there many boys in the underschool at that stage?
I've no idea. I'm sure my recollections of it were of being a pretty small place. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I was unique in that while I was there, my mother inherited some money and did what she always wanted to do, was to go and live in the country. And so she moved out of London, and for one term I was a boarder at the under school, and that was where I used to have breakfast with John, breakfast with John Carlton.
Why do you think your mother chose to send you to Westminster School? Was it purely convenience, or had she heard about it from someone else?
Again, I have no idea. It was organised by my mother. In those days, children were not consulted about those sorts of things. My mother, during the war, had been a member of, it was called the Elizabethan Club, but I don't know that that was the case. But there was an officers' club. In the school buildings, in Little Dean's Yard.
It's called the Churchill Club.
The Churchill Club, yes, right. And my mother was a member of that, and maybe that was what inspired her to think of Westminster.
Oh, how interesting. So she must have been familiar with the location. Yeah.
Yes.
So was the transition from the underschool to the senior part of the school, the great school, fairly seamless?
Yes, I think so. The difficult transition was from Canadian schools to the underschool, where all the other boys, of course, were speaking Latin. No, that's a slight exaggeration. But they were up to speed on Latin. I didn't know what Latin was, and I was always behind. That's how I felt it at the underschool. And to some extent, I think that carried on into the main school.
But your French might have been rather better.
Well, French-Canadian is not really French. And I think if I tried out my French-Canadian, which was minimal, actually, because the Burkes and the Drummonds with whom we lodged were the white Anglo-Saxon elite, and the French-Canadians were their gardeners and servants and that sort of thing. So they didn't speak French at all, except perhaps a little bit to the gardener.
Was the food a real adjustment?
I have very little recollection of that. Am I right in thinking that Mrs. Burr presided over the dining room at Westminster when I got into the main school? And I think she was the wife of the biology master.
Yes, I think it might be Bird or
Bird. Bird. Yes, it probably was. Yes, she was a very nice woman, and I remember her presiding in the great hall with great charm and friendliness, and that rather than the food, sort of is what sticks in my memory.
Were there any Were there any matrons that you remember or that stood out as well?
Were there any?
Matrons that sort of stood out.
Do you know, I'm not hearing you at all.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I am a bit deaf.
No, sorry, I've got quite a quiet voice. Were there any matrons that stood out or that you remember particularly?
Any?
Matrons.
Matrons? Mm. Oh, matrons. Well, in Busby's, I think on some occasion I had a... Did I have flu or something like that? I think on one occasion only... I went into the matron's, what was it called? Not
the Chiswicks?
Something like that, yes. For a few days. Again, I have very little memory of that. I obviously was not tortured. I'm sure I wasn't.
So you started boarding in Busby's when you transitioned
from day one.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what were your first impressions of Busby's house?
Again, I mean, I remember it physically very well, and I remember Little Dean's Yard. And in the course of my life, I've acquired a great interest in architecture, as I indicated to you earlier. And I've sometimes wondered whether it wasn't that the extraordinary qualities of Little Dean's Yard, with the Victoria Tower like one great monster peering into it from one side, and Hawksmoor's towers of Westminster Abbey looking down more gently from the other side. I mean, that is one of the great architectural tour de force of Europe, I think. I mean, it's on a par with the Piazza San Marco. And so I think I remember things like that being tremendously influential. I could draw you a drawing of Busby's. And have you been told about the bathroom at the bottom of the house?
Oh, no.
Well, down at the bottom, in the basement or sub-basement, there was a bathroom with six baths in it. One, two, three. One, two, three. And it sounds amazingly sybaritic. I can remember going down there with some of the other boys, filling the baths absolutely to overflowing. The floor was designed for overflowing, and the water drained away. And we would climb into these baths, sort of three looking at that side, and three with the other three behind us. You couldn't see them. And that's where we would... It must have been in the late or the early evening or something like that. And there we would have this sort of Roman, not an orgy, but sort of relaxed Roman discussion time, chatting to one another.
Did you have to share a room?
Oh, yes. Right. Even until I became a senior, I don't think I've ever had a private room, but there were the dormitories were, well, they must have had 10, they must have had 20 boys in them, 10 beds on either side. And I do, again, perhaps like most boys, I can remember the adventures. There was one boy in my dormitory, I guess probably when I was 14, who we disliked, and I can remember on one night climbing out of my bed, taking a blanket with me. The floors were polished linoleum, so if I put myself on the blanket, I could propel myself underneath the bed, sort of doing this up to wherever the boy was, and there I had some pepper, which I pushed up around his bed. And the reason why this was being done in secretly was, of course, there was a prefect sleeping in the room with us, and what I was trying to do was to avoid being caught by the prefect. I think I was caned for that.
So you didn't succeed.
Well, I made a nuisance of myself, but yes, no, I got my retribution.
Were there any particular subjects that you enjoyed, or
Denny Brock, J. Do you know about Denny Brock, geography? The most beautiful man you've ever seen in your life. He had wonderful chiseled jawbones, and I think he had a cottage in the Hebrides or somewhere like that, or Caithness. And he taught geography. I remember him very warmly. He was a lovely man. I loved his subject. He was a star. And the other one, again, Charles Keeley in the sixth form, you must have heard about him. He was the man who had that that wonderful capacity among school teachers of bringing the outside world into the classroom. And he would bring in a copy of the New Statesman and ask one or other of us, I think, to read an article and then get us debating it. And Tony Howard was the star of that classroom, 10 times cleverer than the rest of us. And he would dominate the debate. But Charles Keeley was I remember him so warmly.
Were you being taught by him in Ashburnham House? Was he in...
Yes, up in the library. Yeah. Yes, sort of sitting in armchairs and, yes, feeling very grand. This was preparation for university, of course, and what an admirable preparation it was. It was making us think for ourselves and treating us as grown-ups.
Did you stop the dreaded Latin?
Yes, I think I must have. In fact, I don't really remember Latin much at the main school at all. It was torture in the underschool, and then I think it faded away, so I must have escaped from it.
And did you have any scientific education? Was there...
I remember only, I think, dissecting a frog, which I suppose was botany biology rather. That doesn't look very large in my memory, so I think I can't have done very much of it, which is a pity because I am a practical person. I like that sort of thing. And the other really memorable thing was Mr. Peebles, who was head, I think, of Rigo's, and taught English. And again, I think towards the end of my time, I can recall doing The Tempest with him, reading it, taking the parts and reading it, and then discussing it. And of course, as a result of all Shakespeare's plays, it's the one I know much, much the best, and therefore love the best. And then it has that beautiful valedictory speech in it, which is so powerful. And I can remember the power of that, even as a boy, knowing that that was something important.
Which part did you have? Can you remember?
No. Certainly not Prospero.
Did many of the teachers talk about their experience in the war? Was there a sense that that was something discussed?
No. I don't remember that there was much sort of personal rapport between us and the teachers. I'm sure Denny Brock was more open than the others. Charles Keeley was all about the intellect. I can't remember anyone talking about the war.
Who was your housemaster in Busby's? Was that Jonathan? Sorry, not Jonathan. Rawls? Is that his surname? No.
No. And you know, I've been trying to remember him, and I can't. Don't have his name.
So he didn't make an enormous impression.
No. I can remember. It's my contemporaries that I really remember, and one of whom, who's still about. I don't know whether you've interviewed him, Roger Norrington.
No, I haven't. The composer, conductor.
Yes. Have a go. He's an interesting man, and I can remember he and I were allowed to stay up late one night, one term, in order to listen to Fred Hoyle giving the Reith lectures on the nature of the universe. And there must have been a radio in the top of the house in the games room. And we used to creep up there and go and listen to Fred Hoyle together. And we've been friends ever since as a result of that, I think.
Was there much opportunity to be musical at the school then?
I sang in the choir, Stabat Mater. So I think the answer was, if you were interested, yes. I never learned an instrument or anything like that. And I don't remember what Roger did. He must have been well up to speed on music, but no. I'm sure he was playing an instrument by then, but I don't remember.
You mentioned the Hawksmoor Towers. I wondered what your memories were like of going in the Abbey. Were you in for a service every morning at that stage?
Right. Well, two memories there. First of all, in the great smogs of the early 1950s. Can you believe it? There were days, it will have been in February, March maybe, or maybe November, when London was absolutely choking with coal smoke. And the smog was inside the Abbey too. And so we would file in for prayers, and that would take place. And then the organist would play his voluntary. And as one left the Abbey, you know, the music would be coming down through the smog in some strange, ethereal way. Because somehow, as it seemed, that cotton wool in the air made the music sound different. And then the contrast was spring days or summer days when the sun came through the coloured glass and everything, even us boys sometimes, were turned into a kaleidoscope of colour, because it was just the sunlight was coming down onto us, or also onto the Abbey furnishings and that sort of thing. And the contrast between those two memories could not be more extreme.
Did you ever go in and explore outside of the school day?
I remember going in and around the little cloister most of all. I think because it was of course, so Dean's yard was green, had trees in it, but the little cloister was somehow much brighter and lighter and had flowers, and on sunny days when the sun poured into it, it was really very bright and attractive, whereas the Abbey was rather gloomy, notwithstanding the occasional sunlight.
Did you visit College Garden much?
Did
you visit College Garden much?
I don't remember ever going there. I knew it as the sort of, you know, the private world, those brilliant people, the scholars, I was not part of that.
And do you have any memories of Parliament?
I've always been well aware that in those days one could just sort of pop into Parliament and go to the Strangers' Gallery. Do you know, I am afraid to say, I'm not sure whether I did or not. I think I must have, because I'm aware of that faculty. But what I do remember much, much more, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to tell you about it, is rowing.
That was going to be my next question, actually, about sports at Westminster.
Yes.
So was it always rowing from the outset, or did you do anything else at Vincent Square?
Yes. I think a few times I went up to Vincent Square to play football, but I must have opted for rowing for some reason or other. Perhaps because it was my Canadian time, I knew how to... We'd had canoes on the lakes, so I was familiar with boats. But yes, so it was that extraordinary business of gobbling one's lunch on, was it Wednesday afternoon or Thursday afternoon, racing down to St. James's Park Underground Station, throwing oneself into the train, getting to Putney, racing across the bridge and over to the boathouse. for the purpose of getting one of the sculling boats so that you could go out on the river by yourself before the sort of formal station began. And I can remember that was something I was terribly keen on. I loved going out on the river by myself. And I don't know at what age in those days one could do it. Certainly by the time I was a senior, I can remember being out on the river at 4:30, 5 o'clock when it was getting dark, and at low tide, and the river completely quiet and glassy, and just going up or down in a sculling boat, and the only sound was the sort of plop, plop of one's own oars, and just being in this amazing piece of nature, although you were in the middle of the city as well. And one just did it. Health and safety, it didn't seem to exist, I don't think.
And what state was the Thames like at that point? Was it...
Well, we were told it was lethal. and one did... all sorts of nasty things came down, dead dogs and contraceptives and who knows what else. And occasionally a body, I think, and the police fished the bodies out. But we still threw the coxswains into the river after races, and I don't remember any of them dying. So the story was that the river was foul, but we survived.
And did you take part in many races?
Yes, because as you will see from my height. I got into the first eight very early. I was in the eight for 3 years, 15, 16 and 17, and ended up as head of the water. And I also, well, that meant I went to Henley with the eight, and I have some very pleasant but not very specific memories of that. But what I do remember was that the coach was Geoffrey Hamerton, who was an Irishman and talked a lot about Guinness and the River Liffey and going to Trinity College Dublin. He was one of those people who brought the outside in, and we loved him for that reason. But in the year when I was head of the water, I remember he came and asked me to take a walk around Dean's Yard with him, at which he told me that the eight was not good enough to go to Henley. And I can remember the tears just pouring down my face, because of course it was, you know, I was the head of the water, and therefore in some way or other I must have been responsible for this inadequate eight, and I knew it. And that was the first great disaster of my life, I think.
So did you largely race on the Thames when you were racing? You didn't travel?
Yes, that was, we took part in the Head of the River race and the Vesta Dashes. And I think I do have very fond memories of rowing. I also can remember rowing in this kind of weather. It was cold on the river. My mother knitted me a wonderful white cable stitch sweater, which was all very well, provided one of the tugs didn't come past and set up a huge wash and fill the boat with water. And then the sweater, which would be waiting in the bottom of the boat to put on when we stopped rowing, would be soaked and therefore no use at all.
What was the uniform like at the school?
It was a grey herringbone tweed suit. I'm sure that was the case later on. I'm not sure what as a junior boy we wore. I don't think it was that herringbone suit, but that's the only thing I can remember.
Now our pupils have quite an exciting array of ties. Did you have different ties?
We had there were house ties as well as the school tie, and my favourite recollection of our house tie, Busby's, which was crimson and magenta or something like that. I met Tony Howard in New York 2 or 3 or 4 years after we'd left the school, and I suppose after we'd left Oxford. And he was still wearing his house tie, and it had by then become sort of curled and furled and fouled with soup that he'd spilt on it, but he was still proudly wearing it.
And did you do anything like the CCF or any of those kind of activities?
Yes, yeah. And it was Mr. Rawes. Does that name ring?
Yes, that's it. Francis Rawes?
Francis, yes. I think he'd been a colonel during the war. Mm-hmm. He was the only person I sort of had a sense of as having been a military man. And he was in charge of the CCF. And I think I remember very little about it, except we went out on manoeuvres once to Epping Forest, and that was and had to crawl through the undergrowth, and that was sort of more interesting than usual. And I remember being so struck by Epping Forest too. I think those 5 years in Canada, where every summer I'd lived out in the wild, as it were, that really injected in me a very great attachment to the out of doors, and so being reconnected with it at Epping Forest, I think that's perhaps why I felt so strongly about it, why I can remember it so well.
Were there many other expeditions at the school? Did you go on trips?
I remember very few. Cadby Hall, which was the headquarters of Lyons, who owned the tea rooms and made tea and, I guess, coffee and that sort of thing. I remember at Cadby Hall, which used to be, it's in North Kensington, maybe it's behind Kensington Olympia, I think, therefore in Hammersmith. I can remember seeing the tea tasters there, having little bowls of different teas and tasting them with a spoon and then spitting what they tasted out, and then they were evidently blending teas, I think, or something like that. I don't remember, really, that's the only visit I can remember.
And as a boarder, were you able to take advantage of London in the evenings? Did you go to concerts ever or theatre?
Yes, certainly. Certainly I got to know London, and I still know that part of Westminster extremely well, I'm sure, as a result of walking around it. And I do remember going to the Victoria Palace, where Hamilton is now showing, and which was, of course, one of the last music halls. And it must have been, probably was 1951, 1951, there was an act called Nervo and Knox, and this is this I guess was the sort of fag end of Victorian music hall. But what I remember particularly is that Nervo and Knox were two men, and at some point, maybe right at the beginning of the show, one of them came, the curtains opened, and Nervo, or was it Knox, I don't remember, started coming out from behind the curtain at one side of the stage, and he stuck his arm out. You could just see the rest of him off behind it. And then a great green spotlight was focused on his arm, which made it green, of course. And he then said, "Oh, look! Me arm's going all mouldy!" And it brought the house down. It was, you know, it was obviously one of those routines that he'd done. They knew it. They were expecting it. Was not expecting it. I'd never been there before. So that's my memory of Victorian music hall.
And were there many plays going on within the house in Busby's?
Peace in Our Time. the Busby's House play, and I was a stage manager in that. Anthony Howard was a star. John Towne was another star.
Where did you perform it? In Busby's itself?
Up school. Yes. And we built a stage. We built the stage set. No, the stage was there. It was a slight platform at the end of the school. So I remember that clearly. And John Towne, who was a great friend of mine, a couple of years younger, he was one of the people whom I shared the bathroom with. Later in life, he was gay and had a partner and moved out to Los Angeles. And we always kept up with one another. But he was one of the people who was a woman in Peace in Our Time, and I've got a photograph of the cast on the stage. He looked so like a woman. He just knew. He'd had high heels on and all of that sort of thing. And that was a strange side of Westminster life. I was never involved in anything I'm in the least bit ashamed about. But there was this strange atmosphere that we were in an all-male world. And it was a bit artificial in some way.
Did you come across any younger women in the school, like the housemaster's daughters or kitchens?
John Christie had daughters, and they wafted about, but they were... I was extremely shy, extremely reticent, terrified by women, so I think I just saw them from the distance.
And were you conscious of when the transition came, when John Christie stopped being headmaster and Walter Hamilton took over?
No, I think John Christie was such a physical presence, called, as you know, Legs. I have such a clear picture of him walking across Little Dean's Yard, like calipers, sort of just his legs, and of course he wore a tailcoat and striped trousers. So a very strong physical picture. It was almost as if he was a cartoon figure. He disappeared, and after that, the headmaster was sort of a less prominent figure, at least in my recollection.
Within the house, was there a very clear hierarchy? You talked about being punished by a monitor when you were younger. You came towards the end of your school career and you were head of the water, were you conscious of being sort of on top?
I suppose so, yes. I've mentioned John Towne, who was gay, and John and I retained a friendship, and he always said of me, and I have no recollection of it, that I was his protector. Being gay, he's bound to have been picked upon a bit, maybe a lot, I don't know. So there was that side of it, and there was a hierarchy, and the prefects. I mean, I can remember as a small boy thinking they were nearly gods. I hope I didn't behave like a god when I became a prefect myself, and maybe I did, maybe I didn't. And then as head of the water, one did have quite a lot of responsibility, organising the stations and making sure that the boys got there in time and that boats were full and off they went. So I remember that much more than any of being an authority figure.
And when you were doing these sort of preparations, running the water, were you also beginning to think about university and life after school?
I've sort of mentioned the effect of the war and being shipped off to Canada on me. In later life, I managed to get a grip on life. I don't remember having much control over anything. I remember feeling that life controlled me, did my mother discuss with me going to Oxford? My father had been to the same college I went to Worcester at Oxford, and was on the war memorial. I can remember the interview at Worcester. I can remember being admitted, and then, of course, I can remember my Oxford years. Another disaster. I failed completely to get any degree. I got nothing. So, Harry Pitt, my tutor, I was the only failure in his career. We became quite good friends as a result of that. But so, as you could see, I had a checkered life at Westminster. Nothing to do with Westminster. The checkering was on me.
But, I mean, not getting a degree is quite a distinction, really.
Yes, I just didn't, and it must have been true at Westminster as well, I really didn't know who I was, why I was there, and as I said, my father was dead, and my mother was a strong, able woman who'd had a very good career during the war in the ATS, and I guess she was my father figure as well as my mother figure.
You clearly did find your niche, even if it wasn't straight away at university. And I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about your career post-Westminster and maybe how Westminster impacted on that.
Yes, I think I come from a literary family, really, because I've mentioned my Swedish Jewish grandfather. But on my mother's side, my mother was Evelyn Palgrave. I don't know whether you know Palgrave's Golden Treasury. This was the first 19th century anthology of English romantic poetry. And Francis Palgrave was my mother's great uncle. One of his brothers was editor of The Economist. My great-grandfather was clerk of the House of Commons. So the Palgraves were a literary, legal family. And their father, another Francis Palgrave, was the founder of the Public Record Office. So they were, again, Jewish, eventually. And as my wife says, if Palgrave's Golden Treasury, as it probably should have been called, had been Cohen's Golden Treasury, it might not have had the success that it had in Victorian England, anti-Semitism being then what it was. But anyway, so I think my mother was a very good writer, wrote beautiful letters, never wrote anything, but I think by the time it came to look for a job and think about that, I thought journalism was probably the way to go. And so after, I don't need to go into again another disaster, I tipped a Land Rover down a ravine on the frontier between Turkey and Iran after I'd left Oxford. That took a little bit of recovering from. I then went off to the United States and got a job on a paper in Chicago. And there were four papers in those days. I got a job quite correctly on the worst and last paper, but that was my first sort of footstep up into journalism. I did that, completely failed to make a success of it, I have to say. And after being a reporter for a period, I was pushed into something else. Did some other work, came back here, and by then I was sufficiently caught up by architecture and town planning. I started writing freelance for the Architects Journal, and then marched into the Guardian one day and said, you know, I'd like to do some work for you. And the Guardian was still in Manchester, but the London editor gave me a job, and 6 months later they hired me as planning correspondent, and I was planning correspondent for the Guardian for about 8 years, and then moved on to the Observer, to the Environment Bureau. So I was already a green in the 1960s, and that's another side of my career. And then I got headhunted when I was on the Observer to go to Paris to work for OECD, the Intergovernmental Think Tank, in the Urban Division. And while I was there, again, just to give you a flavour of why I was there, we had a ministerial conference called Better Towns with Less Traffic. So again, you know, I was absolutely convinced by that time that you could have cities or you could have cars. You couldn't have the two. Cars destroyed cities. And I've been convinced of that ever since, and I have campaigned against cars for the rest of my life. And then I, after OECD, I went, again, that's quite a complicated story, let's not go into it, but I became a consultant to OECD and went on working for them right up until the 1990s. When I came, but then I became the secretary of the Independent Transport Commission, a think tank here, and that was really the last important part of my career. So it was journalism, think tanking in Paris. I wrote a book called Instead of Cars, which was published here in the United States and in Japan. Penguin published it here. And then I ran an urban think tank here with various other things tucked in along the way.
And were you in touch with a lot of your Westminster contemporaries? Did the journalism keep you in touch with Anthony Howard?
Anthony, I used to bump into Anthony occasionally. Roger Norrington was the person, and John Towne, whom I mentioned, they were the two people I kept most in touch with. I got back in touch with John Boyd when I became an amateur sinologist, because I'm working on a book on the future of Shanghai now. And Crispin Tickell, likewise, I met. He was a contemporary of mine, and I became aware of him when he, as it were, converted Mrs. Thatcher to being an environmentalist, and then came across him. Most of my friends are from Oxford rather than from Westminster, or later.
And do you feel positive about the future from an environmental perspective, and encouraged by Greta Thunberg, and or are you disheartened? Do you feel that time has been wasted?
Well, I'm that rare bird, an optimist, I did read history at Oxford, and that having a historical perspective is a terribly sort of comforting, grounding thing. You know that life goes on, and that disaster is followed by joy, and vice versa. And so, of course, I'm optimistic. There will be huge changes as a result of climate change, but we will adapt to them. And the last thing I am at the moment is pessimistic, because the pace of change on the environmental front during the last 3, 4, 5 years is really astounding, particularly reading the Financial Times and reading The Economist, and getting a sense of how the business world is adapting. So, I'm an optimist.
Do you have any things that you would like to say that we haven't given you the opportunity to say?
No, I think we've covered absolutely everything. And will you please edit it and chop a lot of it out? There's a lot. I hope you do edit it, do you?
What we normally do is we do keep the whole recording, but sometimes what we do is we take short excerpts.
What a good idea.
And put those online for people to hear.
Yes. Yes, because as a writer, I'm a passionate believer in editing. there is nothing that can't be improved by a good editor, so go to it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.